Thank you, Brian. Our next speaker is Ian Coller. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of California, Irvine. His book, Arab France, Islam and the Making of Modern Europe, 1798 to 1831, was published by the University of California Press in 2010, and it was the recipient of both the W.K. Hancock Prize of the Australian Historical Association and, oh, yeah, just that, which is enough. It is enough. It recently appeared in French in 2014. That was the other notable point about that book. He was also a recipient of the Australian Research Council Postdoctoral Fellowship from 2007 to 2011. And he recently finished a project that was funded by the ARC titled Europe, Islam, and Modernity, the French Revolution and the Muslim World, 1789 to 1799.
Well, thank you, Angela. And yes, I came to this discussion by speaking with Brian about the Edict of Toleration of 1787, which I came to in a rather different way from the events that I'm going to talk about today, an event of violence against and by a Muslim on a boat traveling down the Yonne. And this really brought me back from the period that I've been looking at post 1789 back to this period of the what's being called the pre-revolution of 1787. And so I was particularly fascinated to see how other categories, Protestants, Jews, were responding in this same period and being politicized in this period prior to the revolution. So I'll start with that moment in October 1787 when a bloody confrontation took place on a barge winding down the River Yonne. Some 60 passengers were crammed into a small space over several days, soldiers, seasonal workers, and a number of young women nursing babies. And amongst them was a man variously described as a Moroccan, an Algerian, a Turk from Crete. Almost the sole point on which all observers could agree was that this man was a Muslim. On the night of the 14th, a few miles past the town of Sens, an altercation took place in the congested quarters below deck, and in circumstances that remain murky, the man, whose name was Ahmed, stabbed two of his fellow passengers to death with a knife, and seizing the axe that the boatman attempted to use against him, wounded several others. The local guard was called and a pistol was fired, smashing the attacker's lower jaw. He died 6 days later from gangrene in the prison of Sens, just as soldiers arrived from Paris to take him back for judgment. And instead of taking him, they took the axe, which ended up in the Hotel de Ville and was seized by the crowd during the riots preceding the days of 5th and 6th October 1789. In any act of violence, it is impossible to get close to the moment itself in its corporeal reality. In this case, I think the Rashomon effect of different readings was magnified by the political crisis in which this story was told and given meaning. We must be careful of reading history backwards and investing this moment with the concerns of today. But at the same time, it can speak to us about the presence and meaning of Islam and Muslims in a moment that has been historically constructed without them. The rapid dissemination of versions of this story speaks to the accelerating nature of politicization at a moment many consider to be the beginning of the crisis that created the conditions for revolution. But it also tells us something different about the wider religious origins of the revolution that have often been understood only in terms of internal dissensions within the Catholic Church. My argument here is that a significant shift in the understanding of religion more generally, one that Lynn Hunt and Margaret Jacob have pointed to in their work on the book by Bernard Picard that changed Europe, played a role in the complex and multifaceted crisis of the Ancien Régime. I want to suggest that these shifts did not simply take place at the level of ideas, amongst Enlightenment elites, but were differentially experienced as a wider societal change that affected everyday life. In the line of insights into the religious experience across the revolution, from Tim Tackett's seminal work on the clerical oath to Suzanne de Sand's revealing study of religious syncretism under the Directory, the story of the Boat to Auxerre can suggest the ways in which religious changes were experienced on the ground, represented and circulated in ways that amplified their significance. In particular, I am thinking in terms of the role of desacralization in the crisis of royal legitimacy, which later flowered into full-scale what became known as de-Christianization of 1793 to 94. And if, as works by Lynn Hunt and Geoffrey Merrick have argued, the desacralization of the monarchy played an important role in creating the conditions of revolution, we should ask what that desacralization means in a wider social sense and how it may be linked to violence. As Benjamin Kaplan has reminded us, quote, tolerance was an issue not just for intellectuals and ruling elites, but for all people who lived in religiously mixed communities, unquote. Jean-Clément Martin has insisted that we think about revolutionary violence in relation to the structural violence of the Ancien Régime built into the functioning of the state. Those structures included the punishment and execution of Protestants that Brian has referred to, interconfessional and anti-Jewish violence, and systems of piracy, abduction, and religious enslavement on what Andrew Hess has called the forgotten frontier of religious warfare between Christians and Muslims in the Mediterranean. The rural Yon may seem far from North Africa, but it in fact sat on the chief artery traveling from the Mediterranean to Northern Europe. In what follows, I want to sketch the immediate context of religious change in which this incident took place, and then trace some of the ways in which this violence was framed and politicized in the shifting revolutionary context. So at this very same moment of October 1787, as we've heard from Brian, the monarchy was working towards the promulgation of this edict concerning those who do not profess the Catholic religion, mostly inaccurately called the Edict of Tolerance. At a time of mounting political and financial crisis, it was primarily intended to resolve this administrative problem by offering a mechanism for legal and economic reintegration of the Calvinist minority, which had previously no legal existence. And it was responding to both the recognition that this situation was costly and wasteful, and to the pressure coming from France's American allies in the War of Independence via Lafayette, for example. The first moves for reform, in fact, had come from the Parlement themselves, yet by the time the edict was submitted to them, their political resistance to royal prerogative gave much greater sway to those who resisted any dilution of Catholic privilege. The king sought to win support with a profoundly minimalist approach, limiting the extension of civic recognition, and I think this is really crucial, to ce que le droit naturel ne nous permet pas de le refuser. It explicitly denied Protestant civil rights while according them the favor of an existence as individuals. In theory, the edict recognized the existence of religious diversity in France, including non-Christians, for the first time in a century. Yet I would suggest that this tolerance was profoundly deceptive, a new fiction to replace the older fiction of a Catholic France that Peter Sahlins wrote about. It served to obscure the troublesome Protestant minority in part by conjuring a kaleidoscopic multiplicity of faiths. Malesherbes, the principal architect of the edict, insisted in his Sur le mariage des Protestants that si la nouvelle loi a l'heureux effet qu'elle doit avoir d'attirer des étrangers dans le royaume, il en viendra de toutes les religions. He imagined a day when colonies de Chinois and Indiens industrieux would settle in France. In the meantime, the new law would allow the registration of the décès des autres hérétiques et schismatiques, des juifs, des idolâtres et mahométans morts en France. This sense that the edict applied to non-Christian religions became a key element, in fact, of the protest of the Paris Parlement against the edict. And they said, il ne sera donc plus nécessaire de professer la religion catholique, ni même le christianisme pour siéger à la tête de l'administration de plusieurs villes considérables, etc. In a model cahier prepared for the Estates General in 1789, the Bishop of Blois challenged the supposed economic benefits of toleration. C'est un léger secours, he wrote, que d'appeler toutes les religions de l'univers, qu'on soit musulman, grec, catholique ou protestant, on n'en rencontre pas moins la taille, la capitation, les vingtièmes, la gabelle, les aides, le contrôle, les privilèges, les compagnies et le fisc avec ses entraves, ses procédures et son inquisition. In a purely numerical sense, evidently, such invocations of Muslims were fantastical. On the other hand, they were no more so than the reigning fiction of a France in which hundreds of thousands of non-Catholics did not exist. Ahmed's story is already an indication that Muslim presence was not purely rhetorical. The sensational violence of the event was, as Michel Foucault said of Lettres de Cachet, a lightning flash of power that shed light on a phenomenon that Jocelyn Dachlia has called the invisible integration of Muslims in early modern Europe. It points to three shifts I want to briefly identify in this moment: a change in the philosophical understandings of Islam, a shift in Muslim mobilities, and the emergence of a nascent politicized notion of rights. So during the 1780s, a whole series of works appeared that challenged conventional views about Muslims, offering new insights beyond the distorting mirror of Christian theology. In 1787 alone, three key works appeared from very different sources: the De la Literatura Turchesca of the Italian cleric Todorini, depicting Muslims as highly literary and scientific people, and in fact translated into French by the Abbé Cournon, who then removed all of Todorini's Jesuit pronouncements on the false beliefs of the infidels. Then the work of another French cleric, the Abbé Pastoret, whose work Zoroastre, Confucius et Mahomet, comparé comme sectaire, législateur et moraliste, scandalously neglected to offer Jesus Christ as a gold standard in that trinity. And at the same time, the Tableau Général de l'Empire Ottoman by the Armenian intellectual Muradja Doson, recently arrived in Paris, which drew a much more detailed picture of Islamic law and religion that had largely been neglected by the encyclopédiste, who had written a great deal about Islam. So these works built on a long-term Enlightenment re-evaluation of Islam, but they were different, I think, in using Islam much more specifically to press for political change in the religious complexion of France at a moment when the French abandonment of the Ottomans in the war against Russia and Austria, which also dated from 1787, was a national scandal. So, in fact, Pastoret, Cournon, and Dawson would all go on to participate directly in revolutionary politics. In 1779, the author of the Lettres de deux curés des Cévennes argued that the king already tolerated other religions in France. Oserait-on faire un crime au roi de France d'avoir souffert pendant 80 ans aux juifs des synagogues, aux protestants leurs assemblées, aux musulmans à Marseille l'exercice public de leur religion? In fact, until they were transferred to Toulon in 1748, the galleys of Marseille had held a dwindling population of Muslim slaves purchased from Italy and Malta. A Muslim cemetery existed to serve their requirements, but as France solidified its treaties with North African states, which made these galleys in fact less important, the cemetery became increasingly identified with the stipulation assuring Muslims of the free practice of their religion in France, a reciprocal relationship that protected the rights of Christians in the Muslim world. The terrain in Marseille was increasingly claimed by Muslim North Africans, either passing through or in residence, and in the 1770s, a series of requests was made by merchant ambassadors and directly from Muslim courts regarding the cemetery and its attached facilities, which led to counterclaims from the Chamber of Commerce that the Muslims had a dessein de faire une mosquée du pavillon qui y est renfermé. Concerned about the reciprocal privileges of the Christians in the Muslim world, the minister Sartin instructed the chamber to provide the keys to Muslim representatives. And in 1777, the local chronicler Jean-Jacques Grosson noted in his annual Almanach de Marseille that depuis lors, nous avons souvent rencontré le vendredi des Mahométans voyageurs qui allaient et revenaient de ce lieu. And indeed, there is an evidence of an increase in the number of these voyages. Consular correspondence reveals numerous North Africans who applied to the Chamber of Commerce in Marseille for assistance in returning home. In 1784, for example, a man named Salem from Tripoli in North Africa arrived in Paris to request help, and the minister was shocked. He said, "Je n'ai pu voir sans surprise qu'il est encore en France," because he'd applied for help several months earlier as well. So Muslims were present in the French colonies as merchants and sometimes as slaves. Masonic lodges also provide a tantalizing glimpse of the Muslims passing through France in this period, as Xavier Yaconneau and Pierre-Yves Beaurepaire have noted. In 1782, when the last parts of the former arsenal were sold off, the Chamber of Commerce in Marseille opposed the sale of the Muslim cemetery, insisting now on its retention on behalf of des Algériens qui se trouvent en grand nombre à Marseille en ce moment. And in 1784, Haji Ibrahim Aga addressed a petition to the Minister of the Marine requesting, au nom des Turcs établis à Marseille, la jouissance qu'il expose leur être contesté du terrain situé près des remparts et destiné pour la sépulture des musulmans. So what we're seeing here is not only a present but a nascent sense of rights, at least reciprocal rights assured under treaties, which I think was crucial in creating a new structure of residence and visibility of Muslims, one that can be seen to play a part in the versions of the story of the boat to Auxerre that occurred after 1787. So return to that story, as sensational as it was, it might well have been expected to just achieve some local notoriety and fade rapidly away. But instead, it blossomed into a variety of politicized forms reproduced at different levels from popular to elite media. The relatively conventional Christian view of the story was spread by Complainte, cheaply produced brochures sold by traveling booksellers, apparently all across France, with lyrics to be sung to popular tunes. For example, Chrétien dans la mémoire, placez-vous bien ce fait, l'action la plus noire commise par Ahmed. A second chanson declared, d'un Turc en folle colère, chacun connu la cruauté. Yet characteristically made this shift to a kind of sympathy with the outlaw. On le prend d'abord, on l'emmène sans aucune compassion. The story also caught the attention of Rétif de la Bretonne, a native of Auxerre, in fact, in his Nuit de Paris. It was an Algerian, he insisted, who had been insulted by soldiers on board the boat, which he pretended to ignore, but une raillerie contre Mahomet étant échappée dans la soirée, ce malheureux fanatique qui ressemblait à tous les autres, avait résolu de se venger et de périr martyr. So Rétif insisted that the story spoke to the ungovernable character of the lower classes, particularly the young. J'ai prédit ce funeste effet, he insisted, en voyant abuser de l'Émile de Jean-Jacques. Thus, the story became one of religious fanaticism in conflict with undisciplined youth, corrupted by the effects of modern philosophy. Rétif denounced as a cover-up a letter from the director of the coach company that had appeared in the Journal de Paris, insisting that the supposed Turk was in fact a Moroccan in his 30s, named Ahmed Bedir, beardless and unarmed and afflicted with epilepsy. The passengers, the director insisted, had done everything to assist him, but Ahmed, hallucinating, believed himself to be captive on board a pirate boat on the high seas and therefore struck out in madness against the passengers. The beard that this letter so carefully suppressed was central to the version reported in the Enlightenment-leaning Mémoire Secret. Here, un Turc ou Algérien, en un mot un musulman, dans tout son costume, was mocked and abused by other passengers who set fire to his beard while he was sleeping. And Bachaumont expressed a concern, a general political concern, apparently experienced in Paris. Cette nouvelle parvenue à Paris y a causé beaucoup de rumeurs. On a agité la question si le musulman n'était pas dans le cas de mériter sa grâce, si son honneur tenant à sa barbe, dans le préjugé de sa religion, il n'était pas en droit de se venger en immolant son ennemi comme un homme qui aurait reçu un soufflet. In this sense, the debate over the rights of Muslims had already emerged, at least peripherally, in the discourses of the pre-revolution. To conclude, then, the violence on board the boat in 1787 is an anecdote. But cultural historians have drawn attention to the role of such affairs in the disintegration of the Ancien Régime, from the story of the Queen's diamond necklace to the rumors leading to the Réveillon riots and the violence spreading across the countryside. In the classical account, such disturbances and preoccupations were historically significant only insofar as they reflected the underlying economic dynamic. Recent historians have paid much more attention to the cultural and religious aspects of political dynamics and their intersections and contradictions with economic interests. Yet these rich reconsiderations have, to my mind, still often remained framed within a methodological nationalism that distinguishes the essential from the contingent based on the quantitative classification of large economic groups in a national economy, whether considered as classes or otherwise. What we can learn from today is that the cultural and political implications of violence and fear are not based on statistical realities. The story of Ahmed, a story that only emerges on asking a different set of questions about the revolution, can challenge the myth of a liberal monarchy advancing towards religious tolerance with a much more complex picture, while reminding us of the violence associated with the sacred boundaries of Ancien Régime society, violence that would resurface with great force in the religious wars of the revolution itself. Thank you.